name is Jennifer Genfuller. What I want to address is the setback from the lakes for the building of residences. And I would suggest that we enact to protect the water quality in McKellar Township by increasing the setback for waterfront for new construction to 30 meters. Our environment is our economy as well as the basis for our health and our lifestyle, and we need to effectively protect the health of our ecosystem. The purpose of having a longer setback is to create more room to absorb rainwater before it carries silt and anthropogenic contaminants into the surface water. When it rains, whatever rainwater is not absorbed into the ground starts to flow downhill. The more rainfall is slowed down, the less silt it carries with it, thus preventing erosion and accumulation of sediment in the waterway. The more the rainfall is slowed down, the more contaminants are absorbed into the ground and held in the vegetation, preventing the development of algae blooms from excess nutrients. The more the rainfall is slowed down, the more it percolates slowly into the ground to replace the groundwater. The leaves of trees and plants hold onto the water, allowing it to drip slowly onto the ground. The roots of the trees and plants create channels in the soil to allow the rainwater to be absorbed deep into the soil. A longer setback also allows a smaller proportion of the cottage frontage to be used for recreation and more for environmental protection. A look at the setback from waterfront requirements in other parts of Parry Sound District shows that most townships require more than a 10-meter setback. Armour, Bracebridge, Jolly, Kearney, Nipissing, Parry Sound, Parry, Ryerson, Strong, and Magnetowan townships all require 30-meter setbacks from the waterfront. Kawartha, McMurrick, Monteith, Whitestone, and the township of the Archipelago require 30-meter setbacks for septic systems. Carling, Muskoka Lakes, and Seguin require 20 meters. Although Seguin requires a 20-meter setback, it also requires that 90% of the property be maintained as a buffer zone in a natural vegetative state. Brooks Falls requires a 15-meter setback. McDougal requires a 10-meter setback. But 90% of the property needs to be maintained as a vegetative buffer zone. Building 10 meters from the lake means that sediment and contaminants are far more likely to enter the lake from the property than if the building was set back further. 10 meters is so close to the lake that it effectively prevents an adequate buffer from being maintained. A 30-meter setback is safer for the environment, and that is why most townships have adopted it. Increasing the size of the setback for building new construction on the waterfront would be beneficial to the environment and protective of the health and welfare of the residents. In reading the new proposed official plan, I did see that the Middle River development, there is a 30-meter setback required, but I did not see a statement that requires an overall 30-meter setback for the rest of the waterfronts in McKellar Township. And I know that the new septic systems are considered to be 90% effective in terms of holding phosphorus in the land. But I was talking about this with a lake scientist, and he said, well, that's equivalent if you have 10 residences that are 100% effective in holding phosphorus from the land. That means you've got one that's equivalent to putting raw sewage into the land. That's 90%. Even if it was 99%, you know, if you have 1,000 residences, then 10 of those it's equivalent to 10 of those putting raw sewage in. So we do still need to look at setback as a general way of protecting the quality of our water. I have a second point, if that's permitted, that I'd like to make. It'll seem a little exotic to most of you, I'm sure, but I have seen some newspaper reports in the last year about rural townships in Ontario having a lot of difficulty controlling the people who are keeping exotic pets. And I think lions and tigers were, if you can believe it, were one of the incidences where, you know, there was no bylaw restricting what defines a domestic pet. Now, I know this new official plan restricts the building of cages or other buildings to hold exotic pets, but I think I would like to suggest that that in, as in some areas, for example, in the city of Hamilton, they've actually defined what constitutes a domestic pet and what doesn't, and I think that that would be a better way to go so that we don't run into any legal difficulty keeping exotic animals out of McKellar. Anyway, that's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you. Whether Tom wants to speak to those?
I think, Jennifer, if I can, through you, Your Worship, brings up an interesting dynamic, which is commonly discussed. Just a couple of corrections. The archipelago, it has a 7.5-meter setback, 25 feet, except where they have environmentally assessed properties. And just so the group here knows, you bring a biologist, 10 of them, into this room, every one of them is going to say 30 meters is a setback. Now, in my world, the reality is counterintuitive to a certain degree. The more you go back, the more people want to see the lake, clear land, and there is a now somewhat defunct principle that if you have to have a septic system and it has to go behind the lakefront property, that can be a positive thing. We're finding, as I mentioned earlier, that's tends to be less and less of some consequence. So the points that I think you have to ask yourself is, what are the benefits versus what are the potential adverse impacts? And I think it's not 30, and surprisingly, I don't think it's 25, even though I owned an island in the archipelago for many years, which seemed like you're on top of the water. So that's something council is going to have to wrestle with. But I think it's something in between 7.5 and 30. And we do have restrictions on buildings that house anything but domestic pets, and we certainly can't define it. That's fair.
Okay, thank you. Next person, just walk up to the mic.
So I think my questions are for the planner.
Oh, just have your name, sir.
Oh, sorry. Reg Moore. So first of all, looking at the agenda for this meeting, it states in number four that the purpose of the proposed zoning bylaw is to update existing comprehensive zoning bylaw with some emphasis on existing. Whenever I look at the township zoning or website, the as posted in effect zoning bylaw is 9512. The as posted in effect official plan policies is February the 6th, 2018. So my question is, why was the December 15th version of the redline version of the zoning bylaw of the official plan used as a document for people to review, and why was the 2019-23 redline version of the zoning bylaw used as opposed to 9512?
John?
Thank you, Your Worship. Through you, I think I'll touch upon this in some of your opening remarks, where the work that was done in 2016, 17, 18 prior to the program going sideways would have had a lot of updates from 9512 that were good changes. It was good work, And it would have been a little bit too confusing to go from the 1995 bylaw all the way to 2024, the draft that's being discussed tonight. So it was kind of a hybrid, so it wouldn't get too confusing and messed up, so that virtually every letter, sentence, word, paragraph would have been a straight cut and a cross out. So we were hoping to achieve less confusion than making more, but I understand Mr. Moore's comment. Thank you.
Can I reply to that?
Yeah, I was going to, but you go ahead.
So I understand what you're saying, but I don't know how that could possibly achieve it, because to me, now to sit down and look at these documents, I have to have a 2015 official plan, the 2018 official plan, which is the in effect official plan, and the proposed red line version. I have to look at all three. How else can I tell what I'm looking at? And the same goes with the zoning bylaw. That doesn't make it less confusing for the normal person looking at this.
The only thing I could add to that is, at the end of the day, we're starting afresh. We're going to replace the bylaw with this new bylaw, so that the important thing is, are you as a ratepayer understanding what the new rule will be? Looking at the history is, to me, secondary to what, in fact, we're going to have in effect going forward. I think that's the best way to explain it. So this process is going to create essentially a new bylaw that will be in effect, hopefully, from 2024. We can get it adopted in this fiscal year. Thank you.
To me, all I'm saying is, trust me, I'm doing this right. That's all I'm saying, because a lot of people may think the old rule is better than the new one. Just like was just discussed with the 15-meter and 30-meter setback. So to me, that's all you're saying is, trust me. And I don't.
I don't think it's a case of being trusted or not. The written word is in the draft and will ultimately be adopted by the municipality. So it's not a question of trust. It's going to be in black and white. And that's what's going to be in effect once it's adopted by the municipality.
Just want to comment as well, with the 95-12, I've spent numerous hours on that. And it's very confusing, even with my background with the planning board over a number of years. This is a much better document, the 2019, and that's the route we're going, and the previous council had looked at that. In particular, all the special provisions turned into exceptions, much easier to follow. I wouldn't want the public to have to go through 95-12 with all of the redlining that John is talking about. And as far as the 2015, if you look at that very closely with the 2018, as suggested, they're not that different. Actually, the 2015 is a misnomer. It has many of the 2018 clauses in there because council put those back in. We had started with the 2018, but we ended up with the 2015 and found out it wasn't that much different. And so right now, that date should not be set in stone, that that's a 2015 document. If you compare it to the original 2015, you'll see that it isn't. It's a mixture. It's got 2018 in it. So we're trying to make it easier, and I think as John said, the end result, can you live with the clauses that are in there? I think that's the key at this point. But I'm not supposed to speak of these, so go ahead.
I just figured this is kind of in the segue. Thanks, Reg, for speaking of that. My name is Eric Holmberg, lifetime cottager. I'd like to request that the red line changes here include the change, what's changed from the existing bylaw that's in place today to what is being proposed now. So I'm looking at the waterfront residential property exceptions over here. And there's some sections that no longer include these minimum front lot area in hectares, which means I have to now convert from square meters to hectares. From what I'm seeing, it's clearly lower, but it's vague now. So I'd also like just to understand the intent of the changes specifically for the waterfront residential, because from what I'm seeing, the minimum frontage is being reduced dramatically. And that's concerning from a number of fronts. Is that possible? To write this point, now that we're in multiple documents, the red line comparison from
concern is?
Sure. I think the approach across the chains would be appreciated for others as well. I'm focused on a specific section right now.
I'm a little bit concerned about where exactly we're speaking, because I don't know that there were a lot of changes to standards. So,
and that's for me to now try to figure it out. So there's like section 7.03.2.18.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
And so I'm not sure on there. There's the first section saying the minimum frontage is not 60 meters. The section below is talking about an exception. That's what I'm referring to, not in the state of Texas. I don't know how that exception now trumps over the initial designation of 60 meters minimum frontage. The exception is a third of that, so I don't know where that applies to.
Just so you understand, we looked at all the special provisions, which, as the mayor says, if you had to dig them up, you had to go find the original bylaw, and it became a very arduous exercise. But we switched them over to a preferred exception format, but we didn't change any of the substance. So that's why I'm asking for some specifics so I can check that for you. But for the most part, none of those standards changed. They only possibly went to apparent generic zoning if the exception was no longer needed. So if it is an exception, it should have been identical to the historical one. So we'll check that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The other clarification I'd be asking for as well, it seems to be stating that, at least on the exception, that an accessory building can be constructed without a main building. But I don't know where that exception applies. It's the current bylaw for the general waterfront residential, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, just on that point, the general principle is that you can't have an accessory building until you have a principal building, but there are, in some cases, there were some exceptions granted by site-specific amendment, but we did, actually it was during Reg Moore's time, I think he was responsible for allowing for a storage building that could occur for properties to allow someone to store equipment, tools, etc., while they were building. So there was an exception that's still in place today. Although the exemption has been increased to recognize the fact that the new non-permanent size for a building has gone from 10 square meters, which was 108 square feet, to 15 square meters, which is 160 square feet. So that's been updated as well.
Yeah, I think just for clarification, the actual zoning standards have stayed the same. The exceptions are special provisions that people have applied for, so it doesn't apply to everybody. Yeah. Yes?
Seeing as how my name was used, I just want to clarify, I didn't permit that. That was a zoning on the part of council to authorize me.
That's absolutely correct. It was a discussion that Reg brought forward. It was a good movement.
I didn't have that kind of authority.
No, but it was a good idea because it removed the sort of proliferation of blue and green parts over people's material goods.
I'd also, while I'm up here, I'd like to ask the planner. He's used a lot of words like generally and things like that, and I'm not quite sure what that means. Like, generally, this will apply.
Well, if I could get a little planner speak on you, when you speak about policy, you look towards more liberal kinds of applications. You look at intent, and you look at reasonableness and logic. So generally is the right language to use. When you look at statutes, which a zoning bylaw is, it's black and white. You either are on one side of the line or the other. It's kind of a stupid thing. It's you're either right or you're wrong. So statutes have no malleability, no flexibility. It's either white or black. But when it comes to policy, you're supposed to apply a sensible, reasonable interpretation. That's planning 101.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else? Up to the mic.
Good morning. Dan Peters. I live on a private road, and in the last year, we've had at least one place that has become a stay-in-place. And it's not occupied by anyone. It's just as you being used as a stay-in-place. It's advertised on the internet. And a second one that has just been purchased in August, and the person is advertises on Airbnb for Toronto, so I have a feeling it's going to be Airbnb that place too. Wondering what the standards are for, number one, short-term rentals and bed and breakfast. Stay and play is a couple of days of staying, not necessarily breakfast supplied, and has definitely more than three bedrooms, so it doesn't fit into the bed and breakfast situation. How is that going to be enforced? Is there going to be fines for that if council allows such a thing? What the standards are, if there's going to be an ability to report these things while remaining anonymous, but they're obviously going to know who it is. But I just wanted to know where council stood on that, or the bylaws, if it's very strict, or if it's because, again, septic fields waste the water and the both waterfront properties.
Okay, John, maybe you just differentiate, although it's not bed and breakfast, but it sounds good, but differentiate between bed and breakfast as opposed to short-term rentals.
I see the differences. See the differences, but how is that going to be enforced or make licensed to ensure that the septics aren't overflowing, they're not causing problems to our lake, and we're not, as neighbors, having to put up with people saying, well, I didn't know it wasn't campfire season, I didn't know this, I didn't know that, and I realize there's bylaw reports because I'm quite aware of that. So just wondering where we're going to go with this.
Yeah, at this point, it's unlawful.
Right.
If someone has a Airbnb where they offer a rental scheme for less than 28 days, that is what's called a short-term rental, which is a legislative number. So the courts have ruled that if you rent for less than 28 days, you're commercial. And essentially, you can't have a commercial use in a residential zone. Council has set it up that they will do one of three things, in my mind. One, they will entertain a program to allow short-term rentals by license. They don't have that scheme in place. Or they might require that someone who wants to rent less than 28 days at a time will have to go through a rezoning application to essentially place it in a commercial-like category, or leave it the way it is now, which is they're unlawful. That has an abundance of consequence with it, as we all know, in terms of laying charges and going before a justice, etc. So the latter is where we are, but they have set the mechanics up in these documents to take advantage of one of the other two options.
Okay, so at this point, I can call bylaw, and they can come down and lay charges on the owner for allowing it to be a stay in place.
They could. What I've found in my experience, because I've been dealing with the whole issue for 20 years, is to try and respond to the behavioral problems, and that being fireworks, fires, noise, dogs on the loose, or even overcapacity septic. Trying to deal with the behavioral issues can sometimes be a lot easier to control than actually the land use issue. Land use issues can generate serious consequences financially for both the claimant, the municipality or neighbor, and the respondent, the person who's doing it. So it's not an easy narrative. start as a call bylaw to get these guys to knock the parties off at 1 o'clock or whatever.
Well, and being advertised on the internet, because I can show it to you on the internet right now, and people can come and rent them.
That is evidence towards a violation of the lawfulness, but in itself, it's not something a municipality can control. I mean, if you look in McKellar right now, I'll bet you there's 30 or 40 advertised in McKellar.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And they're all unlawful uses.
So then there should be enforcement taken.
Well, I think council's struggling with that. And that's why they're hoping to hear from people on the topic and which option they would like to have council adopt when addressing that whole topic.
Okay. I spent 30 years in enforcement, so I just wonder why there'd be a struggle with that. But.
I don't know if the story about our taking it to the courts in a previous example is irrelevant, but at $100,000, both sides decided to stop paying lawyers.
Okay, but at this point in time, laying a charge and going before a justice of the peace shouldn't cost you $100,000.
No, but that would be for the behavioral problems, the fires, the dogs, the trespassers.
Yeah, I'm not talking about the fires and the dogs. I'm talking about improper use of the land.
Yeah, I think ticketing is something you can do, but that in itself is, a $500 fine. Some of these guys are getting 10 grand a week for Airbnb rentals.
Yeah, so increase it to $25,000. There's places that have enforcement of $25,000, and that might slow them down.
You would know more about the enforcement topic. I'm not sure what the limits on POA are as far as ticketing.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Paul Long. I live on Charles Avenue. There's four houses or cottages there. We've had Airbnb next to us, and it's $1,600 a night. So the math is incredible. It's not $300 a night. I'm not anti-rental for family and friends renting a cottage for a week and then swabbing late for recovery. What I have a problem with is the disregard of people renting cottages with the behavior that they can do anything that they want because they're spending that much money. $1,600 is a lot of money to anybody a night. So what happens is, like last night, we have six cars, two trailers, one boat, two jet skis, and the families are really good, but you've got a 6-8 person septic system, and there's at least 12-13 people there. So this weekend's not that bad. Next weekend can be worse, or not bad at all. And I think the rule of city, the municipality saying no Airbnbs is one thing, but I want everybody to understand, including this gentleman here, the township should say, if there's no Airbnbs or Vibros allowed, make that statement officially in a letter to those two sellers. It automatically, Airbnb and Vibro, Monday morning, cancels all the licensing for all the municipality. Boom, like that, because they received a letter saying it's no longer legal. So again, my position is not about rentals. My position is about making a licensing commercial endeavor where people are making an excess of $100,000 a year living 3 and 4 hours away from their cottage. And they could be in Maine, they could be in Florida, they could be wherever. They do not give two hoots to hell what's going on that property. That's the problem that I have. Again, family members coming out and renting your cottage for a week, give me $500, don't care. But the commercial enterprise has to end. And that starts with the council sending a letter to the two biggest sellers on the lake, and there's a hell of a lot more than 40. If you go October 1st of next year, there's more than 100. And I, for one, am tired of having an $8,000 a year taxable base cottage and dealing with the bullshit on a weekend, where I work very hard to enjoy my property. It's not being embraced by the people that are selling it. That's my comment.
Yeah, I'll just ask John in this one. As far as like comments being made, our bylaw often, well, I'd say 100% of the time, reacts to complaints rather than going out and looking for problems. If no concerns come in, nobody complains or raises an objection, what do we do? In Mr. LeBlanc's suggestion there, these people that he's identified, this is the first I've heard of the complaint, so if it's coming into council.
Excuse me.
Thank you. This is a particular one that he's referring to. We don't know the property. We don't know the people. What I'm saying is we can only react rather than through comments to complaints. And so I'm just asking John how we go about that. Should the public be sending in more information and then we follow up on that as opposed to just what we're hearing here today?
Most municipal issues are complaint driven for sure. If I understand comments, I think he would like to have those involved be completely aware of the issues. I kind of made notes that I think he's supporting a licensing approach so that when a property owner comes forward and says, I want to be able to offer short term, they get the license. And on that license, there's a checklist of things like your septic system size, the maximum number of people, car parking, the complete list of the things that they need to be aware of. And I designed the bylaw for Whitestone of that fashion, where they have a site plan that is posted much in the way of a sort of a more robust back door of a hotel room with all of the bylaws attached to the kit, and they pay $400 or $500 for an annual license fee. Now, it helps a bit, but what it tended to do in Whitestone is it drove some of them further underground. And it didn't make a lot of sense because they're getting big bucks too, but I get the frustration. I mean, it's very clear, but I think to start with, call the municipality. Let's get an inventory of these problems because we need to know about them, and that'll sway council in which direction it wants to go.
Okay, thank you. Now, as long as everybody gets an opportunity to speak, but there's no other hands up, so go ahead.
That's why you asked me.
Yeah.
In response to Paul's remarks, prior to my retirement, I'm going to say 2014 in there somewhere. We did exactly what he was saying. We sent a letter to every known rental cottage, municipality did, with only one response from one threatening to have his lawyer come after us. Other than that, we received no responses whatsoever. That was part of the initiative that led to the actual lawsuit that John's talking about that became in excess of $100,000. So in my mind, the problem is, and there's, I don't think there's nothing wrong with doing what Paul's talking about and doing it again, but the council has to have it in their mind that they want to continue with this and enforce it. That's the big thing. If you're going to spend a bunch of taxpayer money and then drop it at the 11th hour, that does nothing. So you have to be prepared to continue on and get it resolved, and then you have the precedent setting case for the future.
Okay, thank you.
Eric Holmberg. I was part of the short-term rental committee before it was disbanded.
it, so I've been impacted by short-term rental for a number of years, and I have found that reporting the incident is really required. So as opposed to me going and requesting a change in the behavior, I've been had my life threatened by doing this, get my passions up. So do report it. When we get the short-term rental committee review, there's a lot more. I think it was probably dramatically underreported from all the incidents that we all experienced. It was on my own case, and I regret not reporting the past. So without the data, we can't do as much. That said, I would like to, I don't know if it's appropriate in this bylaw, for the behavioral issues, increasing fines to the owner of the rental property, that do provide impact. So going from maybe the existing $500 to $25,000, $100,000, going increasing, because behavior will not change unless something like that is impacted to the owner. Is there any plan for anything like that?
We're just information gathering at this point, so you're commenting, a number of people are commenting, and we'll probably have more comments in favor of short-term rentals. So we have to weigh the money. Thank you.
Hello, Peter Duffy. I'm from Dancy Lane. I just wanted to clarify something because somebody else said it is not what I heard. What they're talking about, or I believe what the gentleman was talking about, were short-term rentals. It's not sending letters to the individuals that are renting these places. It's sending a letter to the VRBO and sending a letter to Airbnb. And next week, all those properties will be off. You just got them off the lease. Either it's illegal or it's legal. You're telling us it's illegal, but you're not doing the simplest thing to stop it. And my concern is to bring this to the discussion that's happening here. I don't like us going down the road of introducing things to make illegal, to make exceptions. I think this is a problem. I don't think that part should be changed. I think it should be left as it is, that it's illegal, and enforce it. The second part, I want to speak to what Jennifer said, setbacks. Just quickly, you can have all the science in the world. It doesn't take science to understand that building a house 100 feet from the water as opposed to building a house 30 feet from the water is better for the environment. It's very simple, and that's why almost every municipality in Ontario has gone to 30 meters. So please take that into consideration. Move a little bit further back from the lake. I wish I had known that when I came here. I'm one of the violators I built in the last couple of years, and I built 30 feet from the lake. I can tell you, when I did it, no matter how careful we were, stuff got in there. So maybe a little hypocritical of me to say that now, but it's something that needs to be addressed. Thanks.
Thank you.
Tony Best, I'm Manager Detroit. Just a note for council. I remember in my business career, a general manager called a meeting and said, I got a complaint. And he said, well, for every complaint, you know, the senior vice president had 10 and the vice president had 50 and the online supervisor had 100. So when you hear a complaint, your concern, there's probably a multiple factor up there. Most of us don't like to complain. Most of us like to live in a friendly environment, not challenging people. But often we put up with things that we don't want to put up with. And, you know, it is difficult to suggest that you only relate to formal complaints when they happen, because for every formal complaint, there got to be a whole lot of other complaints. So please take that into consideration.
Okay, thank you. I'm not sure John wants to. The trouble is the paper trail, I guess, at some point will be required. But
yeah, I get the point. I think he's essentially saying there's a lot more real complainant activity out there than you're actually going to ever receive. And so you should act on something, for sure. I had a question for the gentleman before, Peter. He talked about going to VRBO or Airbnb. I'm not sure if I understand if you ask or report properties that are essentially unlawful, will they take them off their system? I don't know if that's absolute, Peter.
Can I answer that?
You can or Peter can?
I was just clarifying his remarks.
Okay.
I explain again. I'm not anti-rental. I'm talking about the commercial application of the lake and how it's getting abused, okay? So if you read anything like I've done over the last 3 or 4 years in the United States and in the world, whether or not it be Sicily, Florence, Naples, whatever, when they've introduced licensing, they've had to control it. That's number one. Number two, anywhere you just Google it, Vibro and Airbnb, if the municipality is vocal about the fact that there is no short-term rentals, Monday morning, everything gets wiped out. So that means whether or not it's you as a council or a municipality or you as a person speaks up to Vibro and Airbnb on behalf of the lakes within our community, Airbnb will just shut everything down. And it happens every week where the cities are getting fed up and they're making that announcement to these two corporations. And what's happening is Monday morning they wake up and they go, what happened to my listing? It's gone. Because it's an illegal activity, illegal use of land. So we don't want to live in a community where we go, okay, you violated this, or you have a fire, or you have this. I don't want to live in a world where we're tattletaling on everybody for their right and their wrongs. I didn't come to the cottage country to ensure that. So we tolerate it, and the point being made, there's a lot more of it going on as far as how we all feel and reporting it to bylaw. I think we're going backwards where we're always reporting and doing this and doing that because that's the rules and the septic and dogs and fires. That's great, but deal with the situation. If it's illegal, make it illegal, send a letter to the two people on behalf of the two corporations, on behalf of the municipality, and just make a simple statement. They got an email account, they got a fax number, send them a letter and tell them it's illegal. Done. We're end this thing, and then decide how you want to do it. Do you want to go Magneto on way where they licensed it and made it very, very difficult and made people aware of what they had to do from a commercial application for renting their properties. And a lot of people sold their cottage and got out of it because they were only into it for one reason, a business application of making money. That's not our community, and that's where I want to stop. But that's a decision that the municipality has to decide. Not by law. It's legal. Make it legal. Send them a letter.
Debbie Sweetman. I totally agree with that gentleman because it's an illegal land use. And the other thing that's not fair is the people that do, like say Glenwood or something, they pay taxes for commercial, which are much higher than residential, are they not? So that's not fair that somebody runs a business out of something where the intention was to be a cottage and you bought in, say, McKellar Township, because there were no rentals allowed. And then suddenly that becomes something that you're having to deal with. The other thing, if they do allow it and you have to get licensing, will this be an annual policing of septics? And like, how will that go about as far as that stuff goes?
My name is Brian Johnson. I was on the SDR committee to look into what was going on in McKellar there. This was a committee that was together for about a year. I know Mr. Jackson saying It's hard to enforce a ban, or to enforce our bylaw. And I won't go into everything we did in that committee. It was slightly flawed. I think, for the most part, council sort of dismissed what we ended up putting into that document. But one of the things I was going to say is, he says it's difficult to enforce our bylaw. Right now, I contacted several municipalities, excuse me, maybe about 15 over the last year, and I contacted ones that were enforcing the bylaw. And I want to get some municipality that was close to ours, and Carling is. Carling has almost identical wording in their bylaw, and they are enforcing it, and they are putting a $25,000 fine on anyone that abuses that bylaw. So I contacted them recently, and they told me that it's pretty well shut it down. He said, most people are law-abiding. If you tell them it's against the law, you tell them you're going to enforce it, they will quit doing it. There will be some people, there's no question, that may want to take it to court. But for the most part, he says it's changed everything. The complaints have died down, and for the most part, they don't have any issues with short-term rentals. So our bylaws, same as theirs. I think we should take a look at that. If you're looking for a model and you're looking to really shut this down, that's what you've got to look at. And there's a number of municipalities that are like that. So I think at this point, to Paul's case, I think we've got to hit it where it's the root of the problem. And that's the people that are doing this unlawfully. So my thinking is, if you're going to go forward and put something in place, why don't we do what we already have in place and enforce it?
In the culture of this short-term rental environment, bought properties knowing that they can afford it because they partially rent the property, and how to create some kind of buffer for those people to maybe wean their way out of it. If it was a sentence off, I know that it's such a big issue for people, and even if it's not an immediate effect on you, it's affecting you indirectly, either by your taxes or your neighbors being unhappy or your lakefront or your total environment. So I'm glad there's something being addressed about it. I just be a little bit concerned about some of the more innocent people that might have got involved without being able to afford their cottage on their own given the prices. So and the only other thought with the request to submit to Airbnb, that seems like a very viable option for a lot of people. I think there are other rental agencies that might just fill the gap. So it might not be the solution that you're looking for.
if you cancel those two big operators, and then there are other kind of more smaller operators that might just begin to fill the gap if we don't have other policies in place. So that's my only comment on that.
Great, thank you. Okay, I guess we'll hear from some people on Zoom. Carter, you're all set. Where's Carter? She's up there? Okay.
Michael Colley, can I unmute?
Hi, Michael Colley from Birdville there. Just a quick comment way back to the exotic animals, and I do agree that people should own certain things, but I'm not sure if the township or anyone really has expertise to determine what's exotic and not, and I've seen that in other townships where they have banned silly things that normally people own, and it might affect farming and other stuff like that, but I think banning these structures but I'll leave it at that. My question was if there's any changes to the bylaws and zoning or the plan regarding severances and development of the township.
I'm going to turn it over to John. If you can. Not so much the animals, but the severances.
I don't, anybody that knows me probably knows I try not to be, but I tend to be a bit of a card. I once put a definition for exotic animals in a bylaw, and I included a group in a community that was done as a joke and never got out of the actual bylaw, and I got into a lot of trouble. But anyway, we had looked at a couple of severance policies, and we've actually not changed the standards except for the rural lot size, as I said, to make it a little easier for dividing land, but it would be at the same standard.
Okay, sorry, I maybe missed that rule. What was the new standard there for rural properties?
Well, for rural properties, it was 60 meters of road frontage and 1 acre, which is 200 feet in 1 acre. We bumped it up to 200 feet and 2 acres to avoid this potential for a cross-contamination of groundwater from settings.
Gotcha. No, I appreciate that. And I guess my only comment concern, because I have been dealing with lots of severances and extra building, is just residents engaged either in farming or other activities, or I've appreciated the rural setting. Obviously, we need housing. The concern is just being able to maintain our activities and seeing with more dense populations, more complaints, right? Animal sounds, smells, and stuff like that. So I'm just hoping somewhere that's thought about in the plan or when services are happening.
And actually, there are provisions about agriculture uses and minimum distance separations and that sort of thing to protect both farmers and rural dwellings.
Awesome, thanks. Yeah, just with a changing township and the demographics and more people or subdivisions, obviously, it's going to be a little bit of a change for our residents. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. We need a better system for gardening here. No other questions?
Debbie Sweeman. So if somebody ends up doing short-term rental, which the zoning doesn't allow, and I guess they're talking about a licensing fee or something like that, would their tax rate change to be a business now? Because it would no longer be, it would actually be a business amongst residential ratepayers. So that's something to change.
Maybe John can speak to what Whitestone's done, but
It's actually more an MPAC issue, and you have to have quite a significant commercial element to be lifted into a commercial tax category. Like, for example, I have experience where cottage rentals are not really taxed at a different commercial rate unless they have a restaurant. So it's more about how it's classified from taxation people versus, so I would guess that it is not going to be taxed beyond a residential tax category.
So somebody like Glenwood, they don't have a restaurant, but would they not pay a different rate than the cottages around?
I don't think so, through your worship. I do not think so. It's really weird.
Wow.
And then like a camp, like Tim Horton's camp, taxed residentially.
Yeah, probably because that's a charity thing, right?
Well, it's all children's camps, as far as I understand, but you need to sort of pour over the impact classifications to determine.
So, like the trailer parks and stuff, they don't have like a commercial type zoning, or?
I don't believe that they would, and if they do, it might be at the same rate. Yeah, and one of the complaints was that people were having significant incomes without paying tax. It's kind of funny, but HST, for example, is, I think, exigible if it's over $30,000 a year, and certainly you could get there pretty quickly at $10,000 a week. Yes, go ahead.
Submissions for the meeting on Thursday. So if you can't attend, or what if there's an issue that you want to sort of further address or bring to council, what should that look, what form should that be in order to bring it to the Thursday meeting?
Okay, we'll call on Carly. I think she's made her email available, but a formal letter would also suffice. Carly, can you speak to that? What's the best form for you for submissions from the public?
The public wants to email deputyclerk@mckellar.ca. I will file the emails.
So just a letter, something like that?
Correct.
Just
an informal email is fine as well.
Okay, just something to bring it to the council's attention. There was one question. I still have to look through. It's a lot of documents to look through, but I thought one that came to my attention was, I think it was for rural property and some kind of limitation as to storing, let's say, vehicles on a rural property, that was being prohibited. I'm not sure if that can be clarified easily now, but that was just something I was going to, because I would think in the area there could be lots of rural properties that have vehicles.
some restrictions for vacant rural land, you wouldn't be able to put accessory type uses or things like storing automobiles, vehicles, etc., until you had a principal use. There is a section in the bylaw called prohibited uses, and I think that if you look under that section, you'll see what the provisions are that apply.
And I guess the question is that something that people want that seemed maybe a bit excessive for the area?
If you look at the list, and it's pretty extensive, make some submissions on it, and council will look at it.
Yeah, I think maybe the idea behind it was that some of those things that are stored can become, I won't say a junkyard, but and this is when you have neighbors concerned too, then, especially if it's within line of sight. If it's a large piece of property, it might be different from just a smaller rural piece of property. And we see it in different townships too, and then of course the township has to get involved in dealing with that. And so if we can somehow limit it about at the outset what you can and can't do with vacant property. So just so you don't find a lot of derelict vehicles lining the property. But I think, yeah, as John said, I think a letter to council explaining your concerns. Great. Okay, we're not serving lunch, so I won't keep you past lunch hour, but if there are any other comments, we'll certainly entertain them, and you have the method now that Carly has suggested, and we will be meeting again on Thursday. I should just explain why it's a Sunday morning and a Thursday evening. This hall is booked, I don't know, almost every day, and it's very difficult to try to go for a weekend, and as I said, we started with council chambers and said, no, we have to use the community hall. Because of the turnout, and that limits the times we actually have this. But as John said as well, there certainly be a more formal public meeting. Did you have a rough date for that again? Not the one on Thursday evening, although we're still having that. But
well, I don't. Hopefully, there's not too many provincial employees in the room. I just don't find them as responsive as I would have liked. So they might kick the can for an indeterminate period down the road, so to speak, and can't say, but officially they had 90 days from June 26th to respond. My experience is that they're going to turn around and say we need an additional month or 2 months, but I would say no. We want to get on with this.
And your no takes... it supersedes their, and we need it.
Well, I warned them that I'm going fishing, and so they have that on the record.
Okay, any final comments for today?
I just want to check if Sharon online had a question.
Okay.
Yes, thank you. I'm sorry, I don't know how to word this. Anyway, I know this may not be pertinent to this meeting, but I'm just curious. I know there's been some issues over the last couple of years with the opening of the bistro. Does anybody have any update on that?
It's private enterprise.